Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. In this three-part series of our podcast, in celebration of 100 years of the Research Institute, we're focusing on the first centers of emphasis at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, how they've grown over the years, and where we're headed in the future. My guest today is neuroscientist and gene therapy expert, Dr. Beverly Davidson. She's the Chief Scientific Strategy Officer of the Research Institute and Director of the Raymond G. Perelman Center for Cellular and Molecular Therapeutics. Welcome, Bev.
Thank you, Sue.
It's good to see you. So I'm really interested to learn about the origins of the Center for Cellular and Molecular Therapeutics. I know it was started in 2005 and dedicated from the very outset to understanding, developing, and applying gene and related cell and nucleic acid therapies. I know that the center has four cores. There's a human pluripotent stem cell core, a clinical vector core, a research vector core, and a comparative medicine services core. Can you explain for our audience what those are and how the sum is greater than the parts?
Sure. It's really a unique set of cores that allows researchers to address questions about their therapies in different model systems and then also make human drugs to then advance to their patients. So let's take, for example, the human pluripotent stem cell core. The idea behind that is there are many diseases for which animal models don't exist or for which animal models may exist, but they share none of the features of the human disease. And this gives researchers tools to begin to address cell biology questions as well as ask if the therapies they're developing can change and impart positive phenotypes on these cell models. The beauty of those cell systems is that you can differentiate them into neurons if you're studying brain disease, pancreas cells if you're studying diabetes, heart tissue if you're studying cardiovascular or cardiac muscle disorders. And so the ability to direct these and drive these into various cell types is really critical for the field. There are also genetic-based medicines that are directed to human genetic sequence. And of course, animal models often don't have human sequences in them. And this allows you to test the utility of your human drugs in human cells. The Research Vector Core is a one-stop shop for vectors to be applied to either animal models or cell models. And it's a less expensive alternative than the clinical vector core. The clinical vector core can take the outcome of the research vector core and advance it to a drug for human application. Before you do any human work, we need to test their safety. And it was only a few years ago where we envisioned having a comparative model services core that lets us do experiments that will satisfy the FDA. We can then take those experiments and submit them to the FDA so that we can move forward with our human bench-to-bedside aspirations.
So it sounds like the clinical vector core is really crucial in that translation of the bench to the bedside. I understand that it's been absolutely essential in the success of some of our recent medical milestones, the first ever gene therapies that have now really transformed the lives of many patients. So why is an advantage for something like that to be here at a research institute and close to the investigators to move gene therapy forward?
I'll give two examples. One is an amazing life transformative therapy for pediatric patients with a particular form of cancer. The original trials were done here at CHOP, and the ability to make and test the actual gene therapy vector was all done here in the clinical vector core. And then those vectors were given to experts in cell manufacturing that put the two pieces together, and those cells were then infused back into patients. If we had to work with contract research organizations and wait in long lines for queues to do that work and make subtle changes to the manufacturing process, there would be this long back and forth that probably would have implicated the lives of our patients. having that clinical vector core here made us very nimble to go back and forth and make subtle changes to the manufacturing process that improved the actual outcome in our patients. That's one example. And then the other example is we have this amazing cadre of physician scientists and scientists that are developing novel ideas and novel drugs. For them to go to pharma or some other organization to make their material to test in patients can take years. There's a huge bottleneck for the actual production of clinical grade vectors. Having that material here gives our investigators sort of a one leg up, gets them to patients faster. They can test their ideas and then come back to the bench to refine it. Again, it gives us the ability to be nimble. It also gives us the ability to recruit amazing physician scientists that want to develop new drugs for their patients.
That's great. As we were talking, it occurred to me that not everybody might know what a gene is, and then somebody who has a gene defect that you want to replace that gene, but they might not understand what a vector is. Can you explain what a vector is?
Sure. I like to think of a vector as something akin to your car, and the gene is you. You use that car to get from one place of origin to your destination, and then when you get out of the car can stay there or go away or whatever, but the bottom line is you're where you need to be. And so a vector is simply a vehicle that allows you to get your gene from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell, and it can either stick around or go away. So vectors can be lipid nanoparticles. You might have heard of those in the context of many of the vaccines that we've all taken. Or it can be actual viruses where we've gutted out all of the harmful material and put in good stuff. So we've taken that Lamborghini and we've retrofitted it with a Model T Ford. Actually, it's the other way around.
And you mentioned one of the parts of the science is tweaking that vector. Is that making sure it goes where it's supposed to go or doesn't cause any other harm?
It's both of those. These vectors naturally evolved oftentimes to infect a certain tissue for their own survival. We take vectors that have natural tropisms, or we create new tropism for those vectors. So something that naturally would go to the lung, now we can use it for brain diseases, for example. It can also be that it goes to places we don't want it to go, which can add safety concerns, and so we try and disable those functions.
You've helped propel cell and gene therapy from an idea to reality for many, many people. Can you tell us what do you see as the future for cell and gene therapy broadly and then particularly here at CHOP?
I think broadly the field of cell and gene therapy is really moving into the next realm where we'll be applying more nuanced vectors, if you will. We'll be refining the outsides of those cars so that they go to the right destinations only. We'll be refining the innards of those vectors and how we express those gene products so that they're safer for the patients. The field is moving more to personalized medicine through vectors as opposed to one vector system for all diseases. We're going to have to be a little more creative in how we deliver these vectors to the right cells and the right tissues. To do that, we have taken a concerted effort to grow in our cell biology expertise and our vector development expertise here at CHOP. I think we're poised to really stand at the forefront in cell and gene therapy for years to come.
What do you tell young investigators that want to learn how to use these tools to really impact patients, whether they're focused at the bench or whether they're trying to translate the work? What do you tell them about their future?
I think the future is quite bright, and we have a national society known as the American Society for Cell and Gene Therapy that provides a cadre of training and development and cross-mentoring for all investigators interested in cell and gene therapy. Here at CHOP, we've created a cell and gene therapy training course for residents and fellows and other individuals that are interested in the application and the distribution of cell and gene therapy to patients and better understanding clinical impact of that research. And for all scientists, it's quite a burgeoning field. The last society meeting, for example, there were about 8,000 scientists gathered in Washington, D.C., which was the first in-person meeting since the beginning of the pandemic. It was clear that there was a lot of life in this field, a lot of excitement. What we've done here at CHOP is create what's known as the Cell and Gene Therapy Collaborative. This has really provided us an opportunity to bring more local researchers into the fold by creating funding opportunities for seed grants. We have brought in a whole cadre of new investigators bringing in amazingly creative ideas in how to improve our cell therapies, our gene therapies. And I just see more and more of that growth here at CHOP, which is very exciting.
Can you tell us what led you down this path? What inspired you and how did your career evolve?
I was studying neurodegenerative diseases that affect boys as a graduate student. It's a really rare disease known as Lechnein syndrome. I would isolate their white blood cells and try and understand at the biochemical level and at the molecular level what was wrong with the gene that was encoding a protein that was missing in these boys. As we were working on trying to understand what's going on in the cells of the brains of these kids, I became intrigued with the idea that we should in parallel work to put that gene back. And so from the early 90s, we have been working on methodologies to get genes back to those cells that are missing those genes. Later on, that evolved to figuring out how we could knock down bad genes. And that led to my introduction into RNA interference and other methods to CRISPR editing now to essentially take advantage of removing bad genes that complements my approaches to putting missing genes back.
The field of gene therapy has had amazing steps forward and then some really significant trials and tribulations along those lines. When things were happening in the world, were there things that were setbacks?
The biggest setback is here at Penn, actually, when there was a gene therapy trial that resulted in a fatality. It set the field back in several ways. One was we lost a cadre of investigators that were poised to enter the space, in particular physician scientists, those scientists that were in between the postdoc to assistant professor stage that were ready to go into the field of cell and gene therapy. There were a number of individuals, including myself, working on trying to improve gene therapies at the time. And what that did was just forced us to buckle down and think harder about the patient and developing the right drugs for the right diseases. And again, moving away from this one size fits all. One virus could be used for treating all diseases. It also made us think more critically about what diseases make sense for gene therapy and what diseases are fairly well treated using current methodologies, either through diet or small molecules like drugs. I was a young assistant professor at the time. It was impactful to the entire field. In the end, the field came out stronger. We learned from that. Certainly everyone was humbled with great remorse for the family, and we had to move forward.
It makes sense, hearing that story, that you focus on better delivery systems and safer and thinking about the targeting of therapies. So for your work, you have been elected to the National Academy of Medicine. It's a huge honor and so well-deserved, and it's for your work in developing innovative therapies and medicines for some of these fatal inherited brain disorders and neurodegenerative diseases. You are an inspiration to people coming behind you. What do you do to inspire people embarking on these careers?
A lot of my work is to help make sure that the infrastructure is there, that we provide the proper mentoring support and the proper foundational support for them to advance their scientific aspirations. It's really fun doing what I do, from training high school students and undergraduates, graduate students, postdocs, physician fellows, residents. I have physician fellows in my lab as well as a young assistant professor. Having the entire spectrum of trainees in the lab is inspiring to me. It certainly keeps me young. And it also helps folks see that there is a transition. There's always forward momentum. We have a lot of vertical mentoring in the lab, as well as cross-mentoring and collaborative efforts. The biggest thing for me is to keep people focused on the fun of science and the fun of learning, and to take those experiences to, you know, make better drugs for our kids.
You've had remarkable success and really had done impactful work at a time when there probably weren't many women role models. And I wonder, are there things you would tell your younger self from what you've learned along the way?
I always had a passion for science. One of the few kids in my little town that had a subscription to Scientific American. And I was encouraged by my parents to continue with my passion. Role models are important, and getting out there and showing that you can do it, and also showing that there are times when you're vulnerable and it's okay. Making sure that they know the imposter syndrome exists. It exists for men and for women, and making sure that women, particularly those with young kids, have the support they need to make the transition from non-motherhood to motherhood, but continuing to work in their careers. And I think we at CHOP understand that. I'm sure we can always do it better, but we are so, so far beyond where it was when I was training.
In science, we're asking questions that are really hard to answer, and often we bark up the wrong tree or something doesn't work that you think ought to work. But then every once in a while, there's an aha or there's a feeling, you know, it's a breakthrough when it happens. Can you tell us about one of those from your career?
Sure. We've had several, and it's really fun. One of these has to do with improving the safety of gene therapy and the ability to turn things on. When you deliver a gene transfer material, in many cases, it's there forever if the cell lives forever, like a cell in your brain. And so it may be that you don't want things to be on forever, and you really want more of a rheostat, you know, a dimmer switch, if you will. I've had this idea of creating a dimmer switch for many years, and we finally had an aha moment about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, and we figured out how to create that dimmer switch, which really makes the idea of applying some of these novel CRISPR editing technologies and some other technologies more of a reality, especially for brain disorders, where we can only express these for a little tiny bit of time. Even the little aha moments that students have are just really, really fun. From the very big ones to the very little ones, we try and celebrate them all.
I always think of someone I was mentoring who sent me an email about some data he'd gotten and something he'd found. I hadn't seen the email till late at night, but I called him, and he was just so ecstatic. It was so exciting being able to share that discovery and somebody who's worked so hard at something to really open up doors to a new future is mm-hmm. really, really part of the fun of mm-hmm. what we do. Well, thank you very much. It's really been terrific, and I hope we get to do this again.
Yes, thank you for having me, and I appreciate your time.
Please join me next time as we explore our centers of emphasis and how they've grown. For more stories about the people of the Research Institute and the incredible work that they're doing, visit our blog, Cornerstone, at research.chop.edu/cornerstone-blog. Thanks very much.